together.
Okay, welcome to our March 25th, 2020 board meeting. I appreciate all of your willingness to accommodate how we normally do our meetings so that we could follow guidance of the no groups of 10 or less. The coronavirus has really changed what we're doing. So I'm gonna give you a few instructions. Whenever you speak, please state your name first so that we know for the record. And once you have stated your name, wait for me to recognize you before you begin to speak. And I will make sure to give you plenty of time to make sure that everyone that wants time to speak can have it. If we can get everyone familiar with the chat function, we will use this function for the making and seconding motions. When voting, please state your name and then your vote. Wait again for me to ask for your vote. Okay, thank you for helping with this. We'll start off with, I'm going to make an amendment to the agenda, and after number four, add a time for comments. We've got some people here to make comments. So can I get a motion to accept the minutes of December and January and approve the agenda?
Can we get closer to the microphone? That has to be great. But we're doing it through the phone. It still has to be great.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, can I get a motion to accept the minutes for January and December and approve the agenda with the amendment to allow for a comment period?
So
Paul James moves to approve the minutes, and Abraham Verdos seconds it.
Any discussion?
I'm going to assume no. Okay, now we're going to go by one at a time. Okay, we'll do the all in favor and start with Ron Natale from Richmond. You hear me, Ron? Approved? Okay.
Aye.
Smithfield. Mike Arnold. Okay. Hyde Park. Craig.
Let me see if that is on me.
There he is.
Aye.
Okay. North Logan. Oh, Lloyd's not here. Logan and Abraham. Logan Cecilia.
Cecilia, are you there?
I'll go back to her. Dave Gary.
Dave did approve through.
Oh, he did
it
through
there. Dave through the thing.
Okay.
But
Jamie.
Aye.
Lyle Lundberg.
Aye.
Sue Sorensen.
Aye.
Lee Aaron. Okay, Lee Aaron. Oh, she's on there. Aye, okay. Gregory.
We'll say Leanne approves your chat.
Yeah. Leanne approves your chat. Gregory Shannon.
So you need to mute yourself every once in a while. It's you. You're causing the echo. There's too many recording devices in here. It's a lot of interference.
Oh, okay.
So every once in a while, just mute yourself.
Okay, Shannon. That's Gary. Okay. Okay, Gregory's an aye. Paul James.
Aye.
Jeff Turley. Oh, he's on there. Aye for Jeff. Elaine Thatcher.
Aye.
Okay, thank you. It's unanimous. Okay. Okay, any comments or questions from the public? Talking to him. Okay. Any comments or questions? members of the public. Are they not there? I think we have some on, just a minute.
Yeah, we do.
How about John Wells?
No question.
Okay, thank you. Any of the others have questions?
Holly?
Yes.
This is Leanne.
Uh-huh.
I am using my husband's laptop.
Yes.
And I'm just seeing my husband's name, Kent.
Oh, okay.
In the comments, that's me. I'm like, who's Kent?
Okay, all right, we'll give you, we'll look at you for Kent, okay.
Okay,
Holly, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great.
Is that Cecilia?
Yes, I just barely got my audio so that you can hear me.
Okay, great. Thank you, Cecilia.
Yeah.
Holly?
Yes.
This is Glenn. I'm just on the phone. I don't have a computer.
Okay.
Here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Glenn. Thank you. Okay, should we, is there no questions, or can they not give us?
I guess there's no questions.
Okay. All right, we'll move on to board business. Number 5A, swearing in of new board members with Curtis. Curtis?
Okay, I'm here. We're going to go first with Sean. Sean, are you on the phone?
I don't think Sean's on.
Okay, so we'll switch over to Elaine. Elaine, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, we'll have you repeat the oath of office after me. I am patroning.
Sorry, I have it in front of me. Do you want me to just read it?
We'll do it in the official way. So I am, state your name.
I, Elaine Thatcher.
Having been appointed to the office of board member.
Having been appointed to the office of board member.
To the Board of Trustees for the Cache Valley Transit District.
To the Board of Trustees for the Cache Valley Transit District.
Do solemnly swear that I will support, obey, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Do solemnly swear that I will support, obey, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
And the Constitution of this state.
And the Constitution of this state.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office with fidelity.
And that I will discharge the duties of my office with fidelity.
Welcome to the board. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, is that all? Okay, that's it, Curtis. Okay, we'll move on to 5B, a consideration of doing the Pledge of Allegiance, and Gregory Shannon's proposing this. Gregory?
Would this be the form of a motion?
Yes, we'll make a motion.
Okay. I would like us to consider saying the Pledge of Allegiance at each and every board meeting. That board member could be assigned by the chair to lead the board each meeting and reciting the Pledge of Allegiance. There would be a one-time expense of an estimated $350 for one U.S. flag and a Utah state flag, two stands, and flag poles. The reason I've been thinking about this is when we take our oath, we talk about supporting both our federal government and our state government. And having been in a few city council meetings, the ones that I've been to do start their meetings with a Pledge of Allegiance, and I thought it would just be something good for us to do. That's it.
Okay, is that it? That's it, Gregory?
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Can I have a motion to accept the consideration or adopt the consideration of doing the Pledge of Allegiance? Okay, is that okay?
It's on the chat.
Okay, all right. I have a motion by Ron Natale and a second by Jeff Turley. All those in favor, and I'll go down the list.
Any discussion?
Oh, any discussion? No discussion? Okay, start with Richmond. Ron?
Aye.
Smithfield?
Aye.
Hyde Park?
Aye.
Logan? Abraham?
Aye.
Cecilia?
Aye.
Dave? Dave Gary?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Glenn Schmidt?
Aye.
Jeannie Simmons?
Aye.
Lyle Lumberg?
Aye.
Sue Sorensen?
Aye.
Okay, Millville, Learon?
Aye.
Nibley? Gregory?
Aye.
Hiram?
Aye.
Providence?
Aye.
And River Heights?
Aye.
And it's unanimous? Okay, we'll move down to 5C. Review the fourth quarter unaudited financials. Curtis will take care of that, and we will vote to accept those. Curtis?
Okay, hold on a second. I've got to share my screen with him, so.
Oh, okay.
Let me find him. I'm trying to find you, Curtis. All right, Curtis, you got the screen.
Okay, Curtis.
Okay, there we go. Can everybody see my screen now?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So we're gonna start with the budget to actual schedule for this is how our revenues and expenses end of the year. There's explanations given in numbers here. Stuff like interest income, you see at number one.
It's not
so if you scroll down and look on the page, you'll see a corresponding number one. You'll see the explanation that we've provided. Hopefully all of you have had a chance to kind of go through that. Just a quick summary, a couple of the key highlights. The lowest of the year, we had initially projected to spend more than we brought in by $475,000 because of our capital purchases. We ended up actually not spending as much and actually have about $1 million worth of what we call net income or basically addition to our net assets. What that means is we have more money to be able to set aside for capital projects. That money is available to be appropriated for one-time projects in the future. Some of the key points you're going to be able to notice is, obviously, we didn't budget initially for anything from the additional sales tax that the county added, and so that simply drops straight through. That's our largest revenue variance. Sales tax came in what own versus liability, what do we allow? A key component here, we addressed this with the audit committee, and Glenn will be addressing this, but this is where you'll see the amount that we say that we'd like to assign or set aside for capital projects at a future date. So that's that $6.2 million figure. Then we presented more of a summarized budget actual schedule so you can kind of see it more at a high level view. Once you can, again, we can see that we're bringing about $1 million in that we didn't spend. And then the last page, just so everybody can see and kind of get a feel, we give you a summary of our grants. We've got our primary, right here, as you can see, our primary federal grants that come through this, what we call 5307 funding. You see the award amount, the amount we spent, and then there's a lot of these grants we'll spend in the prior year, and then we'll tell you how much is remaining on those grants. This line here is what we call our 5311 funds. These are for rural services, so this is the north of Smithfield up to the Idaho border. And you can see the amount. And the last one is the bus and bus facilities. This is for what the state's allotted us in contract form so far for bus purchases. All of these amounts of the amount expended tied directly to our financial statements. And then down below you can see these are allotments that we've received from the state for bus purchases. And we're sitting quite handsomely for what's been promised to us relative to what we're going to be going through, but we will go through that $5 million in bulk purchases as the money becomes available under contract. That's a pretty quick high-level view, just to give you a flavor for, we do a lot of accounting here, trying to make sure everything balances, make sure that we're being frugal, conservative with the money. So basically, I'll turn it back over to Holly and see if there's questions that kind of guide the discussion. I'll maintain control of the screen so you can point out what you want to see. I'll come back up here to the budget actual, but Holly, do you want to kind of open it up for any questions or comments from board members?
Okay. All right, what I'm going to do. He's got
it. You can type it in the chat and I'll respond to a type message too.
All right. Do we have any questions?
Curtis, you need to unmute everyone. You've got control of who's muted and not, just so you know.
Oh, okay. Got it? Can everyone hear now? Yeah. Does anyone have any questions for Curtis? Okay.
So the year-over-year trend for grant money, for operations, it stays fairly stable. For the capital grants, which this last year we had a substantial amount of capital grants, we will go up substantially. When we do the budget, we break out more of the operating. When we're analyzing that from year to year, we don't do that as much. So the trend for operating funds has been very stable, very flat. We've increased our usage of federal funds for operating, but we're trying to maintain that steady. But this last year we had, if I remember right, about $2 million worth of capital grants. The other question is, did we receive any STIC funding? Yes, we qualified for one of the components. So in there was almost $300,000 for the alternative funds which come from the STIC.
Any other questions for Curtis? None? Okay. Can I get a motion to accept the unaudited financials? Do I have a motion to accept the unaudited financials?
Hey, Curtis, can you unmute everyone? I think everyone's still muted.
Okay.
Okay. I have a motion by Paul James. Can I get a second?
This is Jeannie. I move to approve the financials.
Thank you, Jeannie. So Jeannie.
Second. I second.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Ron seconded. Jeannie second. Okay. I will start with Richmond. All those in favor? Richmond? Ron? Oh. Ron? Natalie, are you in favor?
Yes, aye.
Okay, Smithfield?
Aye.
Hyde Park? Hyde Park? Craig? Craig, are you on? We don't have Craig. Okay. Okay, Logan Abraham?
Aye.
Okay, Cecilia?
Aye.
Dave Geary?
Aye.
Glenn Schmidt?
Aye.
Jeannie Simmons?
Aye.
Lyle Lundberg?
Aye.
Sue Sorensen?
Aye.
Lee Aaron, aye. Gregory Shannon?
Aye.
Okay, and I have Paul James down as an aye. Jeff Turley?
Aye.
And Elaine Thatcher?
Aye.
And Craig Wright, are you on? Yeah, it must be gone. Okay. It looks like we have, it's unanimous. Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to consideration of fund balance assignment with Glenn. Glenn?
Can you hear me? This
yeah.
Glenn.
Okay, go ahead, Glenn.
So basically what this is we've got the money in our net position that basically is savings. And as Curtis explained, we have, if you look on your paper, we're recommending that we do the $6.2 million combined fund balance, and we want to use that for capital projects. And let you know that as it being assigned doesn't mean that it's good. Has to stay there as our assignment as board. If in the future we need it for other purposes, we can take care of that. We want to be able to have this assignment showing in our records here so that we can use that for basically for matching for grants as they come in. And a big portion of that is for, we're hoping to develop our land that's in the north part of the valley here to build a new transit facility, and we'll need a lot of that to match that. Curtis, could you kind of go through that a little bit? This is what we're doing there.
I showed the amount on screen, the $6.2 million. They don't talk a lot about that federal grant, but I sure can. There's money that's available right now. We're putting in a grant application and applying for federal funds to do construction of a building. We've laid the groundwork for this pretty well over the last course of the last few years. And now we're going to actually do the grant request. What we're proposing in the grant is that we'll have actual cash on hand, which is puts us in a really favorable position relative to other grant applications. Many of them have to either get bonds or are going to be going out for a vote for a tax increase or pledging current revenue. And they have to get pledges lined up from cities or entities that would be supporting that. We have the cash on hand for the match, which will make us very attractive. By having this amount assigned, it makes the grant application much more feasible, and that's why we're proposing
about, is that right, Curtis?
Yes, typically for capital projects like this, a 20% match is required.
So were we looking, we were talking maybe about a $20 million project, is that right, Curtis?
Yeah, the project that we're going to put in for, we're going to give a range. Probably the way the numbers are finalizing out will be somewhere between $18 million and $25 million. Of federal dollars, and then we would put the match on top of that.
Right. So that's basically what we want to do. I turn it back over to you, Holly, open it up for a motion to approve that, to make that assignment.
All right, thank you, Glenn. Okay, can I get a motion to adopt the fund balance assignment?
So moved. This is Dave Geary,
okay, is moved. A second?
Jeannie, second.
Thank you. Jeannie, second. Are there any questions? No questions? Okay, we'll vote on it then. All those in favor, start with Richmond.
Aye.
Smithfield.
Aye.
Did you get that?
I don't know.
Smithfield. Is that an aye? Oh, we've got a question. Did we get that one? Hey, Leanne has a question. Glenn, or who wants, or Curtis?
I don't have a question.
Oh, okay. Huh?
There's Kent.
Well, Kent's here, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
I just said I don't have a question.
Oh, you don't.
It looks like someone else did.
Okay.
Oh, Kent's Lyle. Kent's Lyle.
Oh, Kent is Lyle. Okay, Lyle? Curtis, did you want to answer that? To Lyle? Is Curtis gone?
Yes. I'm just trying to type in here because I'm having trouble hearing. But my question is, with our ridership declining, what's the need for a new facility, a larger facility?
You want to take that one? Go ahead, Todd will take this.
Sure. So Lyle's correct, ridership's decline. But if you look at why ridership's decline, again, as we've mentioned to the board previously, much of that is on the factor of unemployment rate. When our unemployment rate was at a percent at 4.5%, 5%. We had ridership busting at the seams, and we were breaking the system. It wasn't functioning properly. So you know, as your economy slows, your ridership will grow. When the economy is good, ridership can decline because your choice riders have other choices. Part of the other reason that we need a facility is just for our request for expansion. As this board has heard, and even some on the board have talked about the need to connect to the Wasatch Front or connect to other cities in the community. You need room to house vehicles to do that. And then you look at just the need to maintain vehicles. The FTA, the Federal Transit Administration, has a program called the State of Good Repair. So any investment, which for us are all facilities, all vehicles that are vehicles that carry passengers, so our large buses, our small buses, they have an FTA investment in them. And that FTA investment's 80% typically. The FTA then has the ability to require how we maintain those vehicles and facilities, and they call that program the State of Good Repair. Housing the vehicles outside in our extreme temperatures, the extreme from the negative temperature in the winter, to the extreme hot temperature in the summer, does wear out the vehicles faster. In the winter, for example, we have to idle vehicles longer to get them warmed up. We deal with what we call no starts in the winter with the cold. When the vehicle's air valves are frozen open, doors are frozen, we have to warm those vehicles up to get those things working to make pullout. So this is extra wear and tear. And you see in areas where the vehicles are enclosed, which is what we would do, we would enclose the vehicles in a building that it doesn't, it's kept 45, 50 degrees. It's not, it doesn't have to be kept super warm, but it's warm enough that it doesn't deal with these freezing temperatures. Vehicles last longer. The FTA appreciates that in these types of weather conditions. So it's several factors. It's not just ridership. It's you know, maintaining vehicles, and it's the potential for expanding services as we get requests to expand further. And then it's looking at the population growth over time, which we continue to see again and again as communities expand, their need for transportation expands. These are, all of these reasons are reasons that we're looking at building a larger facility. The ground to the south is not ours. In fact, the ground to the south is Logan City's. We've approached them several times about buying that. They have a master plan, which I can't blame them for this. They have a master plan to use that ground for their future need, for their future services. For example, the light and power department has built on that ground to the south, and there may be need to expand further. And so Logan City owns that property, and at this point is not willing to sell that, which is why the board back in 2010 authorized the purchase of the 17 acres in North Logan. And that gives us the ability to essentially house transit services there from now until the next 50 years, most likely. And so that's why we purchased the property out there. Do we anticipate any saving in the new facility? Yeah, I do believe that's part of why we are looking at doing that. There's been a lot of advancements in technology, and so we can build a facility that takes advantages of those advancements, not only from just the facility standpoint, but from the vehicles, like we said. So you're looking at ability to house, you know, things like solar energy, you know, things of that nature that can help offset the costs of running the facility, operating the facility. Again, the savings on the maintenance with the vehicles. Again, we've seen this in other entities that have vehicles in inside storage. That there is savings from doing that from a maintenance standpoint, and so those are all factors of why we would want to build this facility. Is the ground you are currently on, currently owned, you could place another canopy? No, we've actually looked into that. We've had engineers come in and look into that. There's not room to do that. We're not able to build any further on this facility. It really truly is landlocked. We've had studies done in the last three short-range transit plans. Consultants looked at that. We've had engineers outside of the short-range transit plans look at that. There is just not space. One of the other things as well is the technology in vehicles is changing, and so you're looking at things of electric vehicles and things of that nature. This facility is not able to be retrofitted for those things, and so as the technology changes, it gives us an opportunity to change as well. Canopy would result in the existing problem we have now. Yeah, the facility that we are looking to build would not be a canopy. It would be an enclosed facility, again, so that we could protect the vehicles and maintain them better. The buses have worked fine for all these years. You keep buses 10 years, so there's no savings. We actually are keeping buses for 14 years currently, the larger buses. And yes, you're right that we are able to maintain them because that's what we do, but the maintenance costs are higher than what the studies have shown for places that enclose their vehicles in an enclosed area. Park City, for example, all of their vehicles are in enclosed storage, and they see benefit in reduced maintenance costs on vehicles for that. And there's other areas around the country. That was part of the study we looked at when we were looking to purchase the property. We had Wendell DeShear, a firm that specializes in this, go out and look and And we're one of a handful of places across the country that at that time that did not store their vehicles inside. USU and the school district currently don't store their vehicles inside. No, they don't.
Is that it? Any other questions?
Call for the question.
What was that?
Call for the question. Call for the vote.
Yeah.
Oh, for the question.
They called for the vote.
Okay. Should we start over?
It's up to you.
Okay. I guess we'll start over where we've had all this other information. Okay, let's start with, we've had the motion and the second. Let's start the vote again. Richmond?
Aye.
Smithfield?
Aye.
Hartbark?
Aye.
Abraham? Logan?
Aye.
Cecilia? Cecilia?
So she talked.
Did you say Cecilia?
Yes.
Yes.
Cecilia.
Cecilia?
Aye. Sorry, cut up.
Cecilia?
Aye.
Okay, thank you. Dave Geary?
Aye.
Lynn Schmidt?
Aye.
Jeannie Simmons?
Aye.
Lyle Lundberg?
No.
Sue Sorensen?
Aye.
Lee Aaron Hansen?
Aye.
Gregory Shannon?
Aye.
Paul James?
Aye.
Jeff Turley?
Aye.
Elaine Thatcher?
Aye.
We have one no and with Lyle Lundberg. Okay. Let's see, we'll move on to, the report from the PEP committee on the monitoring review with Gregory Shannon.
Okay. You'll notice in the last two pages of your packet is the PEP committee's executive summary. This will be Cliff Notes explanation, if you will. Should you wish to review the documentation, there's about 55 pages that you have the opportunity to look at. So this is the Cliff Notes. First of all, we'd like to say thank you to the PEP committee, Rhonda Valley, Cecilia Benson, Loren Hansen, Sue Sorensen, and myself. This has been really a two-year journey by some of the members, and some of us haven't been on the PEP committee that long, and getting to where we are tonight. What the internal monitoring does is it ensures the CEO, which we have internally changed the name from general manager to CEO because throughout the documentation it was either GM or CEO, and the PEP committee just decided on one title. CEO has properly implemented his reasonable interpretation of the global ends and global executive restraints. And we'll explain that a little bit. Well, we look to identify any issues that are there, recognize and communicate the success of the organization, and inform stakeholders, city councils, mayors, citizens, etc. This is also an annual review, so there are four sections. The first one, which you see, is Global Ends. It talks about why we're in existence. The second one deals with executive constraint, which deals with the authority of the CEO to make decisions about the means or how things are done, followed by acceptance from the board. The global governance commitment really talks about the standards of the group and the individual behavior of the board of trustees. And then the global board management delegation is the grouping of policies by which the board of trustees transfers its authority to management. Now, the ones that we have been working on, the PEP committee, are the first two. The global end. mobile lens, we had one area that we were going to redefine due to the word using efficiency as related to cost, and it would be better in terms of performance, and that has been ironed out now, but for future rebrews, that will be the terminology we will be using is performance. The findings, which are if there's any issues that need to be looked at, was only one, and that was there part of an environmental impact report is out of the five-year window. Every 5 years, we have to have an environmental impact report, and therefore, we found that unacceptable. Now, there was a corrective action provided by the CEO, and in this year, in the budget for 2020, there is an environmental impact report updated, and is scheduled for that, and the CEO is in negotiations with USU, who did it previously, to have that report updated. The conclusion we found was the global lens is acceptable in all aspects. The global executive constraints, there were no observations, nothing was found, an error. There were no findings that were as a problem that needed to be corrected, and we found that to be acceptable. And let me tell you, this is the Cliff Notes version of this. There is a lot more detail that went into this, and it's been a very learning experience for the PEP committee and the both with Pod and his staff, as many things were developed, and a great deal of thanks go to them for their willingness to work with us on this. I could go into a lot more. Are there any questions?
Do we have any questions for Greg? Gregory?
Just a comment here. Ron Natale, I can't even imagine the hours that he put into driving this. He did a super good job, as well as Todd and Sheree, who worked really hard to provide just volumes and volumes of documentation. And what a great thing this will be, so that the taxpayers know of the checks and balances that exist within this committee. It was just really a, like he says, an eye-opening opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, anyone else? Yeah, Jeff Turley's on that committee also, and we do appreciate all the hours that have gone into doing this and doing all the policy work they've done in the last 3 years, and we appreciate that. It's just gone beyond the call of duty, I think, with what they've done. Any other questions? Okay, can we get a motion to accept the monitoring review?
This is Ron Natale. I move that we accept the report.
Thank you, Ron. Do I have a second?
Greg, a second.
Who was that?
Greg.
Greg, was it Greg? Who seconded it?
Yes.
Did you hear?
Craig.
Oh, Craig did. Okay, thank you, Craig. Okay, any questions? Okay, we'll vote then. Let's start with Richmond. All those in favor?
Aye.
Smithfield?
Aye.
Hyde Park?
Aye.
Hyde Park? Craig?
Aye.
Okay. Logan, Abraham?
Aye.
Cecilia? Cecilia? Oh, Cecilia?
Aye.
Thank you. Dave, Gary? Dave, Gary?
Aye.
Glenn Smith?
Aye.
Jeannie Simmons?
Aye.
Lyle Lundberg?
Aye.
Sue Sorensen?
Aye.
Lee Aaron has said aye. Gregory Shannon?
Aye.
Paul James? Paul James?
Aye.
Okay. We have an aye for Jeff Turley. Elaine Thatcher?
Aye.
Thank you. We're unanimous. Thank you. Okay, we'll move on to 5F. Discuss the board structure and size. I'll just kind of give you a brief on what we're going to do that. We're going to table it because Lloyd was going to conduct a discussion on this. So we've just been discussing in the executive committee some reasons to maybe shrink the board a little bit to make it a little more manageable. Most boards and councils in the state are 10 people or less, and we're at 19. And a smaller board, we feel like, would encourage more dialogue. And it would give the CEO more, it would be easier for the CEO to work with the board members and spend more time with them if there weren't so many. So there's, you know, and having smaller cities, I'll agree on, you know, somebody represent several smaller cities, I think would make the members more engaged. And they would probably, you know, they would be thinking outside the box of just not the needs of one city, but of several. So just kind of keep that on your mind and think about it. And then next month, we will have, Lloyd will hopefully be able to come and conduct a discussion on this. Any questions? Okay, thank you. We'll move on to item number 6. Todd's going to do an update on the loop operations.
So again, we're just not quite 3 months into operating the loop, and effective essentially what, the 13th of March or something around that time, the coronavirus really made an impact on our services. But up until that point, there are some things that we can look at. We've been trendlining ridership on the loop, and there's been some interesting things in that short period of time. One thing I mentioned to the board before is up until we had the coronavirus hit, every Saturday we saw ridership gains over the previous year in the areas that were served by routes 1 and 4 and the areas that are served by the loop. Saturday ridership is usually more discretionary in nature, and so that's a good indicator. Also, weekday ridership, we saw that, we could see that there's definitely some people trying the loop. We could see some upticks in ridership, and then it fell back off to similar to what we'd seen the previous year. Still a little bit below the previous year, but the trend line looked very similar, almost mirrored the previous year. And so what we're seeing is that, and again, I think that goes to what we're hearing anecdotally, that people that are trying it are having positive experiences overall, and that people are trying it. But again, it's still relatively new, and so it takes time for people to try something new and sustain something new. We're excited about what these early things say. However, with the coronavirus, all of that's kind of gone out the window. Currently, we're seeing ridership losses of 60% to 70%, which is similar to what you're seeing nationwide, because people are being told to shelter in place, or because people are having their employment shut down for a period of time. And so who are really riding are those folks that really, this is their transportation choice. Again, you're seeing people that have opportunity to ride the bus, we're making the choice to ride the bus, that now are probably driving just out of being able to social distance that way. So with that, are there questions about the loop before I get into a little bit more detail about the coronavirus?
Any questions for Todd?
Okay, let's see. If you took Route 4 ridership from the loop, what did the numbers look like before Corona? So again, Route 4 serves the university, and the loop serves the university as well. So those are very similar in nature. I mean, if you take Route 4 from it, it's going to affect it the way taking Route 4 off Route 4 would affect it. Yeah, it's going to impact it. However, with the loop, we've opened up a whole new corridor along 4th North, which again is a college, the ridership to the university. And so there's a whole nother segment, and we're starting to see growth in ridership from that area prior to Corona. And that area was continuing to see the ridership grow. So again, I think there's a lot of promise there that overall the trend lines are looking like that. Given time, the loop is doing what we hoped it would do, and is going to start growing ridership. But again, it's early in it. It's a very small sample size, so to say that that's for certain, pretty difficult. And again, with the corona, it's just thrown everything out the window. There's really no way for us to tell at this point. Great question. Mm-hmm. What adjustments have you made since the closure of schools and the rest? Yeah. So that's getting into the coronavirus, so maybe I'll jump into that, and I will address that question about ridership adjustments. So when the coronavirus came out, obviously that is something that was very concerning to us. We immediately met as an executive team, and we've been meeting regularly, sometimes daily, to deal with this situation. The coronavirus is something that's you hear the word unprecedented a lot, because it's not something that we've dealt with as a nation or as a world before, as a community. This is new territory. It's been very fluid. It changes frequently. But from the White House talked about critical infrastructure industries, that they should continue to operate. And we were told very quickly, as we reached out to the Federal Transit Administration, that was us as well, that we should be continuing to operate. throughout this process, we've worked with the health department, and I really want to compliment Lloyd and his staff. They, very early on, before things really had even taken off, they had a meeting on the coronavirus. We were invited to participate in that meeting, where they gave us facts and helped us. We also reached out to them and determined the chemicals that we were using, that they were effective. Again, I've updated the board on some of those things. But again, we reached out, made sure that what we were doing to clean and sanitize the buses were effective. We also, at the facilities where we have employees, made sure that we had Clorox wipes, hand sanitizer, things that we could also protect the employees, give them opportunity to be able to sanitize the areas that they work in. As things continue to progress, we've tried to continue to make sure we're operating safely and that we're operating as we should be. Just yesterday, what's today? Today's Wednesday. So just yesterday, I reached out to our regional administrator in Denver, Colorado, over our region, Cindy Tillwiger, and I talked with her at length about, Cindy, we have questions about should we continue to operate, what are you continuing to hear? Cindy reassured me again that the FDA's response is that we should be operating unless we're told to not operate by local health officials. In fact, on the FDA website, I'm just going to read this to you. It says, the Federal Transit Administration grantees, that would be us, should follow the direction of local and state public health and law enforcement agencies. This local and state information generally is coordinated with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the Department of Homeland Security, and is the most accurate of situations locally. A transit agency should notify the FTA before they suspend service. And she said, Todd, look, unless you're told by a health representative, unless someone in authority from that area tells you to stop service, we want you operating. She's like, now, we leave that up to the local decision makers to make that decision, but that's our recommendation. And the reason for that is because there are segments of our population that rely on the bus system for employment, for medical services such as dialysis. And so our plan is to continue to operate unless we're told to not operate. Just recently, as recently as today, you may have heard that Idaho has issued a order of shelter in place. Summit County in Utah, up in Park City, has issued an order of shelter in place today. And so those are two things, one in the state, one in Idaho, where we provide service up to Preston. But in both cases, they have specifically had public transit as essential services to continue to operate. The case of Idaho, right on their issue, it says that local transit should be used for essential services only. So they're telling their public that need to use public transit to use it, but only for essential services. In Summit County, the same thing. They say essential transportation services should stay in place. And so again, you're hearing the same language throughout the country and currently in our state and in the state of Idaho, that public transit is essential service. So going back to the question, what changes have we made since the closure of the schools? We haven't made any. We're continuing to operate the service because all of the communities that we serve need to have that essential service. And so we're continuing to operate the services as before. We do have contingency plans of what we would do if we were ordered to do things differently. We're going to continue to work with our national, state, and local officials to make sure we have the most current information. With regards to Idaho, I've reached out to Pocatello Regional Transit, who we have our contract with, to see what they're doing in Idaho. I made that call today, and we haven't made contact, but we will continue to reach out to them. And so we feel that we're being pragmatic about this, that we're doing the things that we need to do. Today, we issued an order in our system that we're encouraging people to use the rear door to exit and enter the bus. The exception to that is for people that need the bus to kneel, which means that the front of the bus lowers to the ground, or to deploy the ramp for someone that's in a wheelchair or someone that needs the ramp deployed to walk on the bus. That they can still request that, but we're doing that so that the passengers are further away from the driver. And then we're encouraging people on the bus to social distance. Because the ridership's lower right now, there's opportunity for them to do that. They are able to sit, you know, far enough apart that they can social distance. Again, we're going to continue to clean the buses, disinfect them. But so we are making adjustments as things happen. So that's kind of where we're at right now. Again, would entertain any questions that you have related to this.
I have a question.
Okay.
What is being done to train or have your bus drivers have any kind of guidelines at all if someone gets on who is obviously ill? Like with the coughing, are there masks? Are there sanitizing wipes on the bus so that those who get on the bus would be able to get something that could get the viruses off, like the seat in front of them and the seat they're sitting on? Has anything like that been done?
So that's a great question, Cecilia. We don't have anything on the bus itself. We have it at the transit center here at base, at our facilities, is where we house those things. The cleaning supplies that they could do. I'm not aware of anyone that's got on the bus with that. I'll need to check with operations, but we are encouraging people. We have posted on our buses at the transit center the guidelines the health department's putting out regarding hygiene, regarding social distancing, regarding what to stay home if you are sick. So we are trying to educate the public that way. I will check into if we've had anyone that's been on the bus. I have not heard that, but I'll check into that and get back with you.
That would be great. And I just think having the sanitizers that people can see, I know that they sanitize the buses really well. I'm really impressed with what you're doing to continue the service and still have the buses be safe. But I think if I was getting on, I would love to grab a sanitizing cloth like I do when I go into the store. I used to go into the store. Just a thought.
Sure. I will tell you one reason that we haven't done that, Cecilia, in all honesty and openness, is that the demand for that. We are struggling to find sanitizing wipes, and so we are worried somewhat that, kind of like you see the run-on toilet paper, that if we put them on there, that they would disappear, and there's really no way for the drivers to constantly monitor that. But we'll look at it again. But we are having a difficult time getting some of these supplies, as I think everyone in the area is. But we'll look at it again.
Think of that. It's just not available. That's right.
So we have a question. What measures can you prepare to take, if needed, limit customer-employee interaction to protect employee safety? Whoops. Let me go back up so I don't miss them. Again, that's part of that rear door entry, having people enter at the rear door so that we can have them further away from the drivers. But again, if we have someone that's disabled or needs the ramp or lift, there's really no way for us to do that on the rear door. Enforcing social distancing, there have been areas where we've seen or we've heard buses taping off seating. At this point, we haven't seen a need to do that. We are finding that people are doing that on their own. The drivers can also remind them over the PA if needed to social distance, but at this point, customers are kind of doing that on their own. It happened today on tracks in Salt Lake. Police were called. Elaine, do you want to explain that, your comment?
It was on the news tonight that a track train up near the university, somebody got on who appeared to be obviously sick, and it turned out he had left the hospital against the advice of the doctors. But of course, the riders on the train didn't know that. But I don't know who called the police, but somebody did, and they responded very quickly and pulled the person off the train at the very next stop. So it can happen that someone can get on the train or on the bus and be actually ill and could endanger other people. So the drivers may need to, they may need to call the police or whatever procedure you want to put into effect.
So let me clarify. I probably did not clarify this. The drivers are trained, and they do a great job. I mean, we deal with seizures. We deal with people that have other illnesses, and I have full confidence that, yes, given a situation where there was need, the police or the EMTs could be called, would be called. The folks that are operating are very aware and do a great job, and so I think that they would handle it. But we'll make sure again that we're communicating that. I do think the one challenge in all of this that we're finding is there is so much communication going on, some accurate, some inaccurate, in the world right now, that we probably need to step up our communication. And we met today on that as an executive team, and we're planning on doing some more as far as communicating to the employees. So I think that's a great suggestion. We'll definitely take that out. Another comment here. If ridership is down 60%, why are we still running all routes? Why not make some adjustments, reduce service? I'm seeing 40-foot buses with nobody on them. So I think it's a great comment. If our approach is that every part of the community deserves service, and so just saying, hey, let's shut down this route, you have the potential to shut down service to that community. Now, there is an opportunity. Let's say we run Route 2, run Route 7. There used to be an opportunity, what we would call interline, where we would run Route 2 for a half an hour, and then that bus would go and run Route 7 for a half an hour. You'd have a bus that would run Route 5 for a half an hour, and then it would go run Route 3 for a half an hour. And we could reduce to that level. But again, you're now impacting people's schedules, And so that may also impact people trying to get to employment. It may impact somebody that's trying to get to a medical appointment. And so when you reduce that service, you are essentially reducing the opportunity for folks, and it may not work with their employment schedule. Now all of a sudden they may have not have any other source of transportation, and they may have some ill effects from an employer because of that. So we've made the decision to keep service in place, and we have had just anecdotal, some comments of saying, you know, with all this craziness, it's kind of nice to see that there's still buses running around. There's some normalcy that Cache Valley Transit's still doing its thing. So that's a decision that we've made from a standpoint of providing service at what we believe or is what the board's asked us to do to make the service available for folks during employment and those types of things, and that's why we've made that decision. But again, if we're misunderstanding that, or if the board says, hey, we want you to look at a different scenario, if given that direction, we will definitely go to work on that and come back with a different proposal. But that is why we're doing what we're doing currently. Thank you for that question. Other questions?
Yeah. I have a comment. I just think, and maybe I'm wrong, but I just feel like now everyone who can drive, or they're staying home. But the people who are riding the bus are probably truly dependent on that for transportation. And I just think the stability and consistency of the bus schedule is so important right now. So I think it's great that it's still going strong. I know it doesn't look great to have empty buses, but I feel like this is a community service, and people who are riding the buses that really truly depend on it, I'm sure appreciate it so much. So I think it's great that it's still going.
This is Gregory. I think another thing to take into consideration is that if this go on any longer, it's going to have a huge economic impact on everyone, and especially those of lower income who may be losing their jobs would not have fuel to put into their vehicles to catch any kind of work. With a bus, it's a very strong, viable option. As this thing may grow longer, we just don't know. It's that strong, viable option that can give people hope in a time of fear and panic.
Yeah, I agree.
So one other comment on this is, another reason that we continue to operate is obviously for our employees. We have a dedicated group of people that are truly professionals. You know, they have to get special licensing, they have to get special medical requirements to operate the vehicles, and I think to your comments, Le'Aaron and Gregory, I do believe that, you know, if the economy starts to pause or starts to stall, our history, based on the unemployment rate, tells us that the system may all of a sudden, ridership may not be the concern. It may be how do we handle the ridership. And so again, we want to continue to have this same group of trained professionals operating that system, because that poses a different set of challenges. And so part of this too is that we also want to make sure our employees are getting a paycheck, that their benefits are still in place, and that we keep them. We don't want to lose good people that are here, that come every day, do a great professional job. We don't want to lose them by shutting down and again, having them say, hey, well, I still need to pay my bills. And so that's another portion of this decision of why we're also continuing to operate, because these folks do need the paycheck as well. But again, it's a combination of that. It's our employees and serving the public. It's all of those things wrapped into one.
That's a great point. I just think it takes time to train new employees, and if you have to, you know, even let some go, and then suddenly you see a huge increase in ridership when stores open up and everything gets going again, it takes time to
move up or advance, like accelerating, I don't know whether it was maintenance or projects that because of the downturn you would be able to do with less hindrance or redirect resources from areas that are not utilized right now because of the ridership downturn?
Yeah, we already have employees that are doing duties different than driving, that are doing other things, other jobs, that are trying to that we're dealing with right now because of the loss in ridership. So, we're already readjusting for those areas that we can readjust, like for call ride service when we're not having so many vehicles out there. We are accommodating some of that already.
Our hats off to all of you. You're doing a superb job in a really crazy time.
Yeah, we got good people. We really do. I really quickly wanted to address two things from the last board meeting that I said I would come back and report on. We had two questions. One was, why did the late trips in the board quarterly report go up so much? And I apologize, I didn't have that answer right at the top of my head. I should have known that. But prior to November of 2019, the late trips were defined as late trips departing from our transit center as 5 minutes or more past the scheduled departure time. But in that November of 2019, the National Transit Database, where we reported that, did away with that metric. And so they no longer wanted that. However, we still feel it's valid, but it's not, we wanted to tighten up that metric. So for us, it's not whether or not it's 5 minutes late, it's whether or not it's late at all. So we reduced the time from 5 minutes to zero. So anytime the bus leaves the transit center, any time past its scheduled departure time, we count it as a late trip. So because of the narrowing of that metric, that made the number of late trips go up. And so we're starting a new baseline, if you will, and then we'll be able to trend line that again year over year. So hopefully that explains that. The other question that we had was, what was our average trip length? And so during the weekday, so for 2019, during the weekday, the average trip length was 3.25 miles. And during the weekend on Saturday, the average trip length was 2.8 miles. So just wanted to come back. That was a question that I was asked. And so I just wanted to come back and address those. But that's all I have to report at this time.
Any other questions for Todd? Okay, we'll move on to item number 7, the board chair report. And I just wanted to update you on what we did back in D.C. Todd and I went back in D.C. in February, and that was to do a background work before submitting a grant application to the FTA requesting funds to build a new maintenance, storage, and administration building. And this will be funds through FTA's competitive bus and bus facility program. We met with Utah congressmen and senators with Tim Stewart to line up support for this competitive grant application. And just for the ones of you that are new, just a little bit on the building that we want to do, the facility. It's on about 2800 North and 400 West. And we have local funds of $5 million to use for a match. The land was purchased in 2010 with the help of the Utah Congressional District, or delegation, and it's their 17 acres there. And the environmental work has already been completed, so the project is basically shovel ready if we can get the funding. The funding's been difficult because CBTD is considered one of the best small transit operations in the country. So they often overlook us with the money that's given to other ones that are more desperate needs. We met with Scott Bogren, Executive Director of the Community Transportation Association. We discussed successful approaches to applications that he has seen in other areas and approaches we could consider. We also met with a staff member of the Transportation and Infrastructure section of the federal government. She provided additional information on what to do after the application has been submitted. We were told if we didn't get funding on this or other projects, we could ask for like a debriefing and find out what changes we need to make after the money was allotted and we were turned down. She felt it was critical that the Utah delegation members make phone calls to the FDA selection group once the application has been submitted to stress the importance of the project and their support for it. We then met with each of the congressmen and senators' staff to share updated information about the project and request their support for the project. We asked for specific commitments from each congressman and senator related to the application, such as letters of support or making phone calls supporting the application. They were all willing to support it. CBTV has got a great reputation back there for using the funding well, and there's not waste. We've really got a lot of backing back there. So now our process is to send the grant application in by, I think, is it March 30th?
Uh-huh, yep.
And then after that goes in, there'll be letters of support from the Utah congressmen and senators will go in. And then after that, they will make calls on our behalf. So with Tim Stewart back there, he continues and helps us maintain the build relationships with the Utah delegation and others that can support the district's projects. So that he kind of keeps CBT in their minds and in front of them so they don't forget us. That's all I've got. Are there any questions?
Thank you guys for spending your time, not only for this, but just to keep CBTD foremost in their minds. It's nice to know that we're highly thought of.
Thank you. I guess
well, I have a question.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, you said, how much did you say we have in there for matching funds? And is that different than what Curtis reported on?
That 6.2.
It seemed like there was more in the other.
Yeah, I think there's 6.2.
Okay.
Okay. Anything
right,
else?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, with that, we'll adjourn. Do we need a motion? Okay. So we will see you or hear from you on April 22nd, 2020. See, depending on what happens, be safe and stay well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Everyone stay safe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm not
doing
close.
Okay.